Okay, so let me start by first welcoming everybody, and thank you very much for putting up with all the craziness that we had last time from the mistakes about the website. Everybody, we got that cleaned up. That's good. Let me summarize what we learned from Peter Ackroyd's book, Exile and Restoration, because I think there are three really critical points that help us transition into this study of what happened in the 400 years between the end of the Babylonian captivity, you know, Ezra's return to Jerusalem, and then by the time we get to the first century, where the rabbinic material is really taken over. Okay, and it seems to me that Peter Ackroyd gives us the following. First, and importantly, we don't know what happened with the Jews in the Babylonian captivity. There's really no records of how they responded during that time. Okay? We know that some things transitioned, but we don't have any historical material from the 70 years. We have Jeremiah's proclamation of what they were supposed to do, but we don't see any historical records that tell us what they actually did. Okay? What we do know, and this is the second point, is that several of the assumptions that people have made about the impact of the Babylonian captivity really don't have any historical background to them. That doesn't mean that they couldn't have happened. It just means that we don't have substantial evidence to say that they did happen. And one of those, of course, is the development of the synagogue, right? It's common in a lot of Christian documents that treat the Babylonian captivity to say that the synagogue emerged from this period of time. On the basis that there wasn't any temple, so there had to be some sort of communal worship process, and the development of the synagogue happened. And what Ackroyd points out is we don't have any historical records about that. For all we know, the synagogue could have started much, much earlier. And remember, the synagogue is not a place of worship. It's like a community center. It's really where everything Jewish in the community happens, not just the prayers and the worship on Shabbat, but also basically town meetings and discussions of the politics and, you know, and regulations that govern the community, all that kind of stuff. So it could have started much earlier than the Babylonian captivity and simply carried through the Babylonian captivity and emerges on the other side as a really important part of the Jewish context, right? But what Ackroyd points out is we don't have any history about that. Okay? Do you have a question, Phyllis? Because your microphone is.
I was just curious. They were allowed to worship and practice in Babylon, in Babylonian. Do we know that at all, or do we think that?
Okay, and that's a good point. And we do know that at least the Babylonian kings were favorable toward Jews, because after all, by the time you get to the end of the Babylonian captivity, they get the permission of the then ruling king to return to Jerusalem, and he even assists them with financial backing. Okay? So what we know as a result of the end of the period of the captivity is that by the end of the period, at least there was an amicable relationship between the Jews and the Babylonians. Okay? It didn't start that way, of course. It started with the Babylonians carrying off the important figures and removing the influencers from Israel. But it ends in a kind of reverse situation where the Babylonians are willing for the Israelites to go back to Jerusalem from captivity and rebuild Jerusalem. Okay? So that's important. Okay? The other thing that we've, and so it isn't just synagogue, it's Sabbath. The impact of Sabbath, the impact of Torah study, all that kind of stuff that we think emerges as a result of the Babylonian captivity doesn't have historical records to back it up. It doesn't mean that it isn't correct. It just means that it's something that we would have to approach with caution. And of course, the last part of the study that we learned from Ackroyd is that some kind of really important transition did occur during the Babylonian captivity, because we know that the Jews adopted the Babylonian block text. They adopted Aramaic as one of the languages, right? They adopted certain Babylonian customs, right? And we saw that, as Ackroyd points out, some large number of Jews actually assimilated into Babylon. They didn't return to Israel, and they became part of the Babylonian Empire, even if they maintained their Jewishness. They adopted Babylonian customs and thinking. Okay, but the Jews who returned, and this is the last part of what we learned from Aykroyd, the Jews that returned took those Babylonian ideas back with them, the block script that they use that we still have today, right? The Aramaic language that was now part of the linguistic milieu of the first century Israel. So Yeshua spoke Aramaic. He spoke Hebrew. He probably spoke, I'm sure he spoke Greek. He might have spoken Latin. All that cultural mix of the various languages comes out of the Babylonian period. Okay. But here's the point. It didn't affect everyone because, as Aykroyd points out, only the influencers, only the people who represented a threat to Babylon were actually carried off. A great part of the population was just left there because they were basically farmers and villagers and fishermen, and nobody cared. They didn't have political consequence. Okay? So this is really important because what it means is when the Jews return from captivity, they return not to an empty and barren land, but to a land that's already occupied by two generations earlier of Jews who have always been there, right? So the Christian assumption that as a result of the Babylonian captivity, the Jews of the first century spoke Aramaic, and for example, you get Mel Gibson's movie done entirely in Aramaic. You remember that the film when it came out, okay? That's based on the Christian assumption that basically the land was empty and people came back from Babylon and repopulated it. But that's obviously not the case, and scholars wouldn't say that that was the case because Babylon only took away the people that mattered. So the people who remained there continued to speak Hebrew. And one of the things that we find out that helps us feel confident in that is that the ossuaries, the tombs that come from that period are predominantly in, the writing is predominantly in Hebrew, okay? So what that means is it's perfectly reasonable to suggest that Hebrew was still the lingua franca of Israel, even if Aramaic shows up as a result of the return of the captives, okay? Really important, right? Because it helps us understand that the Greek translations of the Gospels really were translations of Hebraic speaking, not Aramaic. And in those particular cases where Aramaic is clearly used in the Gospels, you'll remember that it's always translated. So, for example, when Yeshua is with the daughter of Jairus, who he raises from the dead, right? The conversation is in Aramaic, and the gospel writer translates for the reader. If it had been in Hebrew or in Greek, he wouldn't have had to translate, right? So clearly Aramaic was a language that was spoken, but it wasn't spoken so widely that it didn't require a translation for the reader, okay? The really important point, okay? But really important because it helps us understand how to do exegesis of the gospel accounts. Okay, so now we're ready to move into Lawrence Schiffman's book. And this is a really important book because what Schiffman says is, okay, we could look at the history, as Aykroyd points out, there's very little to look at in terms of the historical accounts of what happened in Babylon. But Schiffman is more interested in how did the ideas change? He wants to follow the transformation of the ideas. And of course, that's what we need to know because we know what the ideas were prior to the captivity, right? The whole Tanakh is about prior to the captivity. All the books of Moses, all the, you know, historical documents, all of the discussion of the kings, all of the prophets, except Ezekiel, come before the captivity. So we have a really good idea of how Jews thought before the captivity. Now, what Schiffman says is, well, we need to understand what happened in the transition of ideas, not necessarily the historical record, although that's part of it, but the significant changes happened in the way that Jews thought about who they were, their relationship to God, how the world was going to, you know, continue, et cetera, et cetera. And that's what he wants to follow. And so this book becomes really important because ultimately Schiffman doesn't talk just about what happened after the Babylonian captivity up to the first century. He talks about what happened during the entire rabbinic and Talmudic period that leaves us with modern Judaism. So now we're going to see, what was the transition? How did we get to the point where, you know, where I can sit down with the rabbi here in Parma and we can talk about things? And that transition changed the way that he thinks. And I need to understand what that transition was. Okay.
Hey, Chief, so one quick question before you get into everything. We don't know anything about the ones that stayed in the land. We don't have any history. We don't have any ideas.
That's right.
We don't know if they have rabbis, you know, or they learned.
And you're exactly right, Phyllis. We don't have any history about the people who were left behind in Israel during that period when Babylon carried off the influencers. We have, and basically, there's no historical records that help us fill in the gaps. What we have are the stories that came after the return. And so then we have to read back and say, okay, well, if this is the case, then these things must have happened. For example, the Babylonian block script. We know that the Babylonian block script occurs after the captivity. So it wasn't there before the captivity. It was Paleo-Hebrew. When they come out 70 years later, they're writing in Babylonian block script. So we can say, oh, you see, that happened. But what happened to the people who were in the land? Your guess is as good as mine. What we have is the archaeological record, but we don't have any historical texts to tell us what was going on. Okay? All right. So let's jump right into Schiffman, because there's really a lot of really good stuff here to help us see how these ideas transformed. Okay? And that's what we really want to know. What was the transformation of the idea? Okay. You'll see right away at the very beginning on page 2, Schiffman says, hey, listen, I'm interested to tell the story of ideas. Okay? So we don't go to Schiffman to look at history. We go to Schiffman to see how did the ideas develop. It's the same thing that I try to do with today's words. I mean, I'm always asking, where did that idea come from? Okay? So this is what Schiffman's going to help us see. During the 400 years, where did the idea come from? And he says, behind the continuity that so often asserted by the tradition that there is a complex development that we seek to uncover, the existence of such a history should in no way be taken as a challenge to the affirmation of continuity made by the Jewish tradition. On the contrary, continuity can only be achieved in a tradition which adapts and develops. In the case of Judaism, stagnation would have led to an early epitaph. Okay? What's he saying? It's simple. If you only accept and follow the commands, rules, regulations, and precepts of the Torah, you go out of existence. Why? Because the process of what God is doing has to be adapted to the culture as it changes. And after the Babylonian captivity, there was a lot of evolution in the culture. Therefore, the Tanakh, the writings of the Tanakh had to adapt. Okay? Now, why is this so important? Because it's still happening. That's why. The whole point of the Talmud and all of the subsequent discussions for the last 1800 years have been adaptation to the culture, right? There's nothing in the Talmud that talks about pushing the button on the elevator on Shabbat, but it's a big discussion when electric elevators came into play. In other words, the religion has to adapt to the culture, okay? Now, we look at that and think, yeah, but that means that they're not doing the same thing that was happening with Moses. And the answer is, of course not. How could they? If you only did what Moses told you, you would never adapt to the culture and you'd be out of existence. You'd still be nomads trying to live in a, you know, desert wandering environment. I mean, the whole point is religions only survive if they adapt. And of course, that's precisely what Christianity did as well. Except the difference is Christianity syncretized with existing religious cultures. It, you know, the idea of the church with the altar in the front and the pews facing the front and all the stuff that goes on, including the steeple, is a syncretization of pagan religions that were involved, that were already in practice in Rome. The Jews didn't syncretize. They merely adapted internally to what was happening so that their religious tradition could continue. And this is such an important point, because we often think, oh, if we could only go back to being like the first century messianic believers, right? Guess what? It will never happen. Never anywhere on the face of the earth, because 2,000 years later, the culture isn't the same as it was in the first century in Israel, and there's no possibility that it ever will be, right? So the only way that you can have a messianic community in the modern world is to have an adaptable messianic community, not to return to the idyllic view that we're going to be like the, you know, the Acts 2:42 church. That's not going to happen, because we don't live in that kind of world anymore. And if we try to make it into that kind of world, we will basically work our way out of existence, because after one generation, we'll just stop existing, right? We can say the same thing. We can see exactly what happened with Qumran, the Qumran community that isolated itself and said, we're not going to have any influence from the outside world, amazingly lasted about 300 years, but it's not around today. It disappeared because it couldn't adapt, okay? So Schiffman's really critically important point is, it isn't now a criticism of the Jewish tradition. It's actually an endorsement of adaptability that keeps Judaism alive. Okay? Now let's go to the next quote. Assumptions of a radical discontinuity between the various manifestations of Judaism in the Second Temple period and the Rabbinic Judaism are highly overestimated. In fact, Rabbinic Judaism represented the fruition of ideas already part of earlier approaches and provided an eventual rallying point around which a consensus emerged. So here's what he's saying. Rabbinic Judaism wasn't a radical departure from what was already in place. It was merely a development. The ideas of Rabbinic Judaism were already present in the culture, and they were simply developed. They were simply enlarged, right? So we should look at Rabbinic Judaism not as a brand new radical, you know, religious view that comes onto the scene sometime in the 4th century BCE. We should look at it as a continuity of what was already present in the culture and simply now came to fruition, okay? So he says, next citation, apocryphal and pseudepigraphical texts, a collective designation for texts which narrate how a supernatural figure reveals to a human being hidden truths about the secret of the universe. These secrets usually include predictions of the eschatological, that is, messianic future. So here's what we've learned, and we learned this from Akeroyd already, okay? There were lots of documents that were in circulation in the religious sacred communities of the Second Temple period. And those included, as you know now, Book of Enoch, Assumption of Moses, Testament of the Twelve, et cetera, all this kind of stuff. In fact, there's thousands of pages of this kind of apocryphal and pseudepigraphical texts. And I would argue that that's been going on way earlier than simply the beginning of the captivity. Song of Songs is a pseudepigraphical text, right? It asserts that it was written by Solomon, but obviously can't be, because it uses language that didn't even exist until long after Solomon was dead. I could say the same thing about some passages in Deuteronomy, which looks like they must have been written during the time of Josiah and put into the mouth of Moses. So this process is going on for a long time. And what Schiffman is saying is it continues. In the 4th century, 3rd century, 2nd century, 1st century BCE, the process is still going on. There's still apocryphal material. There's still pseudepigraphical text, and they're being written in a way that they can be incorporated into the sacred community and believed as the word of God. Okay? And what's typical of them is a supernatural figure reveals secrets about what's going to happen in the universe, particularly at the end of the age. Okay? And you can, if you've read Enoch, You can see that, right? The Enoch has a discussion with the supernatural angel who then reveals to him all this stuff. And that theme happens again and again and again. And you're very familiar with that theme in the Apocalypse of John, right? The book of Revelation fits exactly this pattern. A supernatural figure reveals to a human being how the world is going to shake out. Okay? So if you grew up in the Christian world, you think, oh my gosh, this is a text about the end of the world. What you don't realize is that there's 25 more of them, or 50 or 100 more that are like that pattern, right? That don't ever make it into our canonized Bible because they don't have the name John associated with it, right? But if you go look, you can see this other stuff. And Schiffman's pointing out that process, that pattern of development of material was going on long before the Babylonian captivity and just became more evident afterwards. Okay, now he says in the next citation, interpretation, more technically exegesis. Okay, what's the difference between exegesis and interpretation? We have to know that right away because he really wants to talk about exegesis. Okay, tell me what the difference is. Somebody who's more brilliant than I can turn on their microphone and tell me what the difference is. We have no volunteers. Okay. Let me suggest a follow-up. Oh, somebody wanted to say something. Yes, please.
No, I'm too stupid. I can't. I was just thinking, is exegesis like a direct I can't think of the word, like a direct translation, not so much translation, but looking at the word and seeing what it actually means and all that, where an interpretation involves more general type? I mean, I just...
Okay, so let's make sure that we understand this, because this is really, really important when we're dealing with the Hebrew text, okay? First, exegesis is technically the science of understanding the language in terms of its meaning to the original audience. Okay? So it's not adding my interpretation. It's simply saying, when Moses said, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is one," right? The Lord your God is one. I need to know exactly what he meant in terms of the understanding of the original audience. So that means I need to know the vocabulary, the grammar, the syntax. I need to know the cultural background of the language. It's all the scientific exploration, okay? The kind of thing that we try to do every day in today's word, at least part, right? We say, okay, here's the Hebrew word, or here's the Greek word, here's what it meant in the culture, here's the grammar of it, what's the verb tense, et cetera, okay? Now, how does that differ from interpretation? Interpretation is me saying, what does it mean in terms of my understanding? Not application for me in particular, but here's the interpretation of, here's what Moses said, here's the grammar, the syntax, the vocabulary. Now let's look at, what does that mean? Moses is in the Shema. Moses is really talking about a monotheism, right? That's an interpretation of the text, monotheism. The actual text is about what it means to say echad, the Hebrew word for only. Okay, one. One. Does it mean one, or does it mean alone? Then I interpret that as something about an idea of monotheism. Now, here's the important part. And we've said this before, but it's really, really important when you're dealing with the Hebrew text. As Zornberg points out, every reading is an interpretation. Why? Because there's no vowels, right? The very fact that you have to put the vowels into the text means you're interpreting what the words say, because all you have are the consonants, and you can't read the consonants, so you have to add something to the text itself in order to be able to read it. And when you add those things, you are bringing your idea of what the vowels should be into the text. Okay? So Schiffman wants to talk about what constitutes the basic patterns of development as exegesis. But what we need to add is Zornberg's comment that exegesis actually never actually happens. What happens is a form of interpretation. And in our case, if we read the text from the Masoretic text, the Masoretites are the ones who added the vowel points so that we would read the text according to their interpretation, right? This is really, really important because every translation of the English Bible that I know of begins with the Masoretic Tiberian text. And the Masoretic Tiberian text is already interpreted by the Masoretites because they added the vowels, right? So when we go back to Qumran and we see the text without the vowels, we might get from Qumran a completely different understanding of precisely the same verse because they read it differently. Okay? It's so important. It's the difference between this and this. It's the difference between Robert Alter's version of the Five Books of Moses and Eric Kaplan's version of the Five Books of Moses and the NASB, NIV, King James, et cetera, et cetera. Right. Why? Because these two guys are Hebrew Jews and they read the text differently, right? And in Walter's case, he often says, oh, by the way, the tradition treats the text like this, but it could be read like this because of Canaanite, Ugaritic, Aramaic, et cetera, right? So you need to know that kind of stuff when you come to the Hebrew text. So that's what Schiffman is saying. It's not really, he's saying it's interpretation, but it's called exegesis, even though we know that what's happening is interpreting the text. Okay, so now look what he says. Interpretation, more technically exegesis, constitutes one of the basic patterns of the development of the history of Judaism. It's only one, right? This process of adding vowels and saying what the text means is only one of the development processes. The Bible itself shows evidence of internal interpretation, what scholars now call inner biblical exegesis. What does that mean? It means that, for example, some verses in Chronicles interpret verses in Kings, and they change the meaning, right? Sometimes what happens in Chronicles actually undoes what the verse says in Kings, right? And it happens inside the biblical text, right? For example, he says, Deuteronomy, oh, it's supposed to see, may be seen, sorry, my mistake, may be seen to a great extent as a recapitulation and interpretation of the books which precede it, right? What he means, of course, is we know that Deuteronomy is the, quote, second giving of the law, okay? But Deuteronomy, if you look really carefully, there are things that happen in Deuteronomy that actually contradict or seem to contradict what happens in Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers, okay? And actually, we wouldn't be too surprised if Deuteronomy was really written much later and put into the mouth of Moses to make it official. Okay? So that's one example of what he's talking about, right? He says, Ezra and Nehemiah, for example, reveal pronounced tendencies toward exegesis of a type later called Midrash. Okay? How do we know that? Because Ezra and Nehemiah take material from what they claim is the Torah, the five books of Moses. Remember, they find the scroll and they read it and everybody weeps. How wonderful is that they found the scroll. And then Ezra interprets what the scroll says in order to give rules for how people are supposed to behave. Okay? All that stuff is happening in the biblical text itself. So we should be surprised that the rabbis do the same thing? Of course not. What he's saying is that process of interpretation via exegesis already was in place in Ezra and Nehemiah, and probably earlier than that, and the rabbis just continued it. That's all. They didn't bring anything radical and new. They just continued it. Okay. So, now the next quote. Ultimately, the schism between Judaism and Christianity was expressed in terms of exegetical issues pertaining to the Hebrew scriptures. You can put that one in underline red, because look what he's saying. He's saying the break between Judaism and Christianity didn't happen because of historical changes, right? He's not saying, you know, the Bar Kokhba revolt and the subsequent realignment of Jews with a different Messiah is the reason that Christianity and Judaism separated. He's not saying that. You know what he's saying? that it was exegesis that caused the separation. In other words, the Christians read the text differently than Jews. And we know that's the case. All you have to do is think of the doctrine of the Trinity, which the Christians read from the same text in the Tanakh, right? Jews read it one way, Christians read it another. That difference in interpretation, in exegesis, is so significant that it divides them forever. There is no possibility of reconciling that doctrine. Because on the one hand, the Jews believe that God is one. And on the other hand, Christianity believes that the Godhead is three persons. You can't reconcile that, even though they claim the same theological textual basis. Okay? So Schiffman is absolutely correct. By the time you get to the second century, the issue over exegesis is what divides the two great monotheistic religions. Okay? Let's go to the next quote. Rabbinic Judaism saw itself as based on an interpretive tradition, which it called the oral law. Okay? Now, why is that so important? Because in Rabbinic Judaism, the written law isn't enough. End of story. Okay? It isn't sufficient to have just the Tanakh, because the Tanakh needs interpretation. And the interpretation is what the rabbinic Judaism calls the oral law, the oral Torah. Okay? Now, there's a whole lot of discussion about when did the oral Torah come into existence. And what's really interesting is rabbinic Judaism claims that the oral Torah was given to Moses at the same time that the written Torah was given. And it was passed down to the elders and then to Joshua and Caleb, et cetera, so that there is a continuous stream of oral tradition provided alongside the written tradition until we get to Judah Nasi, the Judah the prince, who actually wrote it down for the first time in about 200 CE. Okay? But what rabbinic Judaism claims is that oral tradition goes all the way back to Sinai. Okay? Now, who's going to say otherwise? Who can stand up and say that isn't historically accurate? The point is, it's the traditional explanation of why the oral Torah is just as sacred, perhaps even more so, than the Tanakh itself. Why does rabbinic Judaism today spend most of its time studying the Talmud instead of the Torah? Because the Talmud is the adaptation of the Torah to the present life, right? I can study the Torah as a historical document, and I know what Moses said, but that doesn't help me deal with, you know, walking down the street where I've got a car coming by me. I need to know how it works today, and that's the Talmud, right? So the idea of rabbinic Judaism is God prepared for that all along by giving the oral tradition to Moses, which is the adaptable side of the written tradition. Okay? Now, I'm making a big point of this because by the time we get to Christine Hayes' book on the law, the difference between oral and written is huge. It actually separates Christianity from Judaism, right? And it makes a huge difference on how you understand what the divine law is. Okay? So just put that away in the back of your head and be prepared for a discussion of the difference between oral and written when we get to talking about the law. Okay, so Schiffman goes on. When the Babylonian Talmud achieved undisputed hegemony in the early Middle Ages, the rabbinic corpus joined the Bible as the canonized scripture of Judaism. Okay, so there's really important things happening in this little citation. First, you know that there are two Talmuds, the Babylonian Talmud and the Jerusalem Talmud, okay? If you didn't know that, then now you do. The Jerusalem Talmud is much smaller than the Babylonian Talmud. And there are reasons for that, and we're going to explore some of those, okay, later. But look what he says. When the Babylonian Talmud achieved undisputed hegemony, when did that happen? In the first century? In the fourth century BCE? No. Look what he's saying. Early Middle Ages, 1,000 years after the ministry of Yeshua, 1,000 years after the destruction of the temple by the Romans. 1,000 years went by before the Babylonian Talmud became the standard interpretive document for Torah. Okay? 1,000 years. Something happened during that 1,000 years. And by the way, one of the important things that happened was the rise of Islam. We forget how much influence Islam had on Judaism, right? When does Islam come onto the scene? 580, 600 CE. So the Babylonian Talmud is there, but in the next 300 or 400 years, the Babylonian Talmud becomes the standard interpretive text. So much so that today, as I pointed out, if you go to a yeshiva, you will study the Babylonian Talmud. You might have a sidebar once in a while to the Jerusalem Talmud, but you almost never study the Torah directly. Why? Because the Babylonian Talmud is the equivalent of sacred scripture in Judaism, right? What does he say? In the early Middle Ages, the time of Maimonides, Nachmanides, Rabban, all those people that were happened in the Middle Ages, right? When Spain had a dominant Jewish community, right? When the Jews were spread out over North Africa, right? When things were happening in Europe that began a long series of pogroms against the Jews, that's when the Babylonian Talmud became the standard text. Okay? Now, next quote. Even groups like the Pharisees, which did not, supposed to be did not, which did not seek to adopt Greek cultural patterns, were not left untouched by Hellenistic influences. Wow, here comes the next big point. Peter Ackroyd shows us that when Jews left Babylon, they took certain Babylonian practices and thinking with them. In fact, so much so that they changed the way they wrote the language. Okay? Right? Now, what Schiffman points out early on in his book is that even the culture of the Pharisees, which refused syncretism, still was influenced by Hellenistic ideas, because Hellenism was the metaphysical and cultural dominating idea of the entire Mediterranean world from the time of Alexander the Great on. Okay? And by the way, it's still part of our culture. What Alexander the Great did in the 3rd century BCE affects you today, because you still live in a Greco-Roman world, right? So there's no way that that wouldn't have influenced the Pharisees. And what we want, remember, Schiffman is talking about the history of ideas. So what he's saying is, okay, we have these influences going on. Babylon and the Babylonian Talmud, okay? Islam, as we're going to see, and Hellenism. Those influences shape what happens in Jewish thinking over the course of the 400, 500, 600 years from the end of the captivity, and that's where the history of ideas comes from. So now we're going to follow those ideas and see where the influences are. Okay? So, let's look at the next quote. From its beginning, Jewish history has experienced a recurring pattern of meeting, or perhaps confronting, some new modern culture and coming to terms with it. Okay? That, he's not talking about, you know, post-1947. He's talking about 4th century BCE when it was influenced by Babylon, 3rd century BCE when it was influenced by Hellenism, 1st century when the Romans came into play. I mean, all this kind of stuff is going on. So he says, from the very beginnings of Jewish history, it's always been this pattern of conflict and what to do about it, right? The process has so far repeated itself 4 times. The first was when Israelites invaded the Promised Land and came into contact with the superior culture of the Canaanites. Okay? Let's stop right there. Israel, you remember what God said when he says to Joshua, I want you to take over the land? Does God say to him, I want you to take over the land, leave the Canaanites there, and then just sort of make sure that you don't take over their practices? Is that what God says? What does he actually tell the Israelites to do? Eliminate them. Everything about them. get rid of their culture, kill the people, kill the animals, destroy the cities, don't have anything to do and no reminders left when you go into the promised land, because God says, if you leave anything there, it's going to tempt you to syncretize, to bring them in. Okay. Now, as you know, Joshua makes a big mistake. And he allows the Canaanite culture to exist side by side and intermingled with the Jewish culture that comes in, with the Israelite culture that comes in from Egypt. Okay? And we know by reading the historical texts of the Bible that it causes all kinds of problems. All kinds of problems, up to and almost including civil war. Okay? So that's the first time. The second time, says Shiffen, the second took place in late antiquity when Judaism came into contact with Hellenistic culture. So now we're talking about 3rd century, 2nd century, 1st century BCE, up to the point where Yeshua comes on the scene. Hellenism. The first is the Canaanites. The second is the Greeks. Okay? The third took place in the Middle Ages when a major part of the world Jewry found itself under Islamic domination. So, 1, Canaan. 2, Greece. 3, Islam. And the 4th is Europe and the Renaissance under the Enlightenment. So 4 major cultural shifts occurred, and Judaism is influenced by all of them. Okay?
And so many of them hated and wanted to kill us. I wonder why.
Well, when the Israelites came into Canaan, the Canaanites weren't there, you know, waiting to kill them. It was the opposite. Israel came in to kill the Canaanites, okay? But the influence was the same because they didn't do what God said. They didn't wipe them out. And so then they intermingled the ideas. Okay, that's the important part. The second point is Hellenism, you know, the Jews didn't get rid of Hellenism. In fact, there was a large population of the Jewish establishment, even in Jerusalem, that created a Hellenistic and Jewish environment, right? Remember, there was a gymnasium right next to the Temple Mount, right? So there was a good part of Judaism that adopted Hellenistic ideas, believing that that would advance them, okay? The third part was the Middle Ages, when Islam dominated North Africa. And what we're going to find out, and I'll give you the little hint, is do you realize that Jews embraced Islam as a savior for them when it first came, when it first marched across North Africa? Why? Because the Christians were killing the Jews. And when it's, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, right? So Islam fought against the Christians, and the Jews said, oh, thank God Islam came along and saved us. They later changed their mind, of course, which is really weird because today it's polar opposites. But when it first started, the Jews embraced Islam as a saving grace from God. Okay? And the fourth, of course, is the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, which, by the way, didn't just affect Judaism. It affected the entire Christian world. Right? We live with the results of the Renaissance and the Enlightenment. Right? We live with the idea of bringing back Greek thinking, the Enlightenment, into the political, economic, and social world of Europe. Okay? So these are major shifts in what happens in how the world understands itself and its relationship with God and who men are, etc. And Judaism has survived all of those, but it hasn't survived intact. It's always had to confront and modify. Okay?
So there's a two-state solution being talked about in Israel.
Yeah, exactly. Israel today is a nation state. As a nation state, it's a Greco-Roman culture, right? It has laws, rules, politics, voting, et cetera, et cetera. That's all Roman, Greco-Roman. That doesn't come from the Torah, as the ultra-Orthodox in Israel would clearly say. You're not living biblically. You're living according to Greco-Roman ideas. Okay? So Israel's got this internal conflict over basically two different approaches to culture. Okay? Let's look at the next concept, or the next quote. The concept of the dual Torah, the oral Torah and written Torah, written and oral, gave rabbinic Judaism that flexibility, defining the interpretations of the later rabbis as having Mosaic authority and standing in a continuous chain of tradition. Why is that so important? Because if the oral Torah wasn't given to Moses, then man made it up. And it doesn't have the authority that I need it to have in order to command the way that people should behave. But if the oral Torah was given to Moses along with the written Torah, then it comes straight from God, even though it was only passed orally until it was finally written down. It comes straight from God, and it has exactly the same standing as the written Torah, and therefore I am obligated to keep it.
Okay?
And rabbinic Judaism recognized that the oral Torah granted it the flexibility, the adaptability, right? So I can talk about the Shabbat elevator, okay? I have to have flexibility and adaptability. But the claim that it comes from Moses, given to Moses by God at Sinai, means that it's absolutely obligatory. It isn't a matter of, well, I don't feel like doing it. It's exactly what God wants. It just was passed down orally, not written. Okay? I have to have that claim, because otherwise it's just whatever men make up. And by the way, you shouldn't be surprised, because it's exactly the claim of the Catholic Church. Right? The Pope is God's spokesperson in the world, and that chain goes all the way back to Peter, the first pope, right? And it's an unbroken chain of spiritual authority passed on from one pope to the next. So what the pope says is what God says. It's exactly the same idea, right? It shouldn't surprise us one bit, because it's exactly the way Christianity lived and continues to live in the Catholic world today. Right? Not until Martin Luther came along was there any concept at all that I'm accountable only to Scripture. And unfortunately, even Luther didn't get that, because then Luther and Calvin and Zwingli and all these other guys basically took over the role of the Pope. Right? So it wasn't enough to read Scripture. I had to know, what did Calvin say about it? What did Luther say about it? Today, what does Geisler say? What does John MacArthur say? We have, instead of one pope, we have multiple popes, and they stand up in the pulpit every Sunday and tell us what God said, right? The chain of spiritual authority keeps the religion alive. Otherwise, it ossifies. It becomes a dead religion, okay? So the rabbis pick that up and put it in the mouth of Moses. The pope picks it up and puts it in the mouth of Peter, endorsed, by the way, by the Messiah. Okay? And the Protestants basically defer to the Pope every Sunday who stands in the pulpit. It's the same idea, that you have to have a continuous chain of flexible interpretation in order to keep the religion alive. Okay?
Skip, 2 points real quick. So didn't they talk about the oral Torah also coming, being even older than Sinai? Like, because, you know, Abraham, and how did they know how to behave and how to, you know?
Okay, we're going to come to a lot of discussion of that in Christine Hayes's book. But basically, rabbinic Judaism does not say that the oral Torah predates Sinai, because what happens at Sinai is God's direct revelation to men. Okay? What they will say is that certain principles and behaviors, that, for example, the Noahic laws, were actually in place before that, but they weren't given to men from the mouth of God in the way that Sinai occurred. Okay.
Okay. And the other
they were there because civilization demands certain kinds of behaviors. You can't have a civilized world without them, and so of course they were built into the way that God created human beings. But that's different than given as a revealed concept.
Okay, and the other thing is, when we talk about Israel being a nation state and a Greek, I mean, really, old Israel was not a democratic political, you know, it was
Israel in the Tanakh is a theocracy. Until the monarchy, Israel is a theocracy. God is the ruler. There isn't any parliament. There is no voting. There's no representational government. Nothing. God rules. Okay.
Right.
And subsequently, under the monarchy, it's the same. The king rules. He rules in God's name, but there's no Supreme Court to decide if he's keeping the law. Right? That doesn't happen until the Greco-Roman system. It doesn't happen until Athens. Athens is the beginning of democracy, and that's the fourth and third centuries BCE. Okay?
Skip?
Yes.
In the light of this, what do we do with Yeshua's comment where he says, do as they say, not as they do, because they sit in the seat of Moses?
Yeah. So Yeshua is saying the seat of Moses is the seat of spiritual authority over the community. Okay? And what he's saying is the rabbis sit in the seat of Moses, and when they do, they act as the spiritual authority for the community. They just don't live according to their own decisions.
Yeah.
Right? In other words, what he's decrying is their hypocrisy. He's not telling you that you don't have to listen to what they say. What he's saying is they are the spiritual authority in the community. Just practice what they say, not how they act.
But would they have referred to the oral or the?
Of course, he refers. Look, he's saying, you know, listen to the rabbis when they sit in the seat of Moses, and the rabbis believed in the oral Torah and the written Torah. So, yeah, look, Yeshua is not—he's not a Karaite Jew. That doesn't happen until the 8th century CE, right? He's not a Karaite Jew. He's part of this whole thing. He's part of the rabbinic community, right? And in fact, many of his parables actually depend on interpretation in the oral Torah to make sense. Okay? So Yeshua is a product of his age, right? He radically disagreed with the hypocrisy that he sees in the Pharisees, but he doesn't radically disagree with their view of sacred documents. Okay?
Interesting.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, let's continue. The concept of, did we read that? Yeah. Judaism is fundamentally a revealed religion. It is based on the belief that God revealed himself to the Jewish people through the agency of Moses. By the way, that's a really important sentence. Because if you don't have Moses, you don't have Judaism. And Moses isn't God. Moses is God's agent, right? There are lots and lots of parallels here if you start thinking about the Gospel of Matthew. Okay, let's keep going. For this reason, its development, both in the biblical period and beyond, can be understood only in terms of a reshaping and reinterpretation of the biblical heritage. The traditions of the biblical world were axiomatic for later Judaism. Meaning and message were debated, but not authority. This is really important, because what he's saying is this. You might disagree over what Moses says in terms of boiling a kid in its mother's milk, but you never challenge that Moses said it, and that he said it because God told him. Okay? That is not challengeable. That's axiomatic. The axiom is God said it. What it means might be debated, but there's never any question that it came from God. Okay? So, notice his comment. For this reason, its development, both in the biblical period and beyond. And what he's saying is, it starts off with the revelation at Sinai, but it never ends. Because even today, discussions that occur in rabbinic Judaism, in Talmudic Judaism, never question that God didn't reveal this stuff to Moses. Our only issue is trying to figure out what it means. It's never a question of where it came from. It came from God, period. oral or written. Now the question is, what does it mean for us? How do we work it out? Okay? By the way, that is as strong a claim as the Quran comes from Muhammad and the bulls come from the Pope. It's exactly the same claim, right? No Muslim ever will challenge that Muhammad didn't have the revelation in the cave. That is axiomatic to Islam. God revealed himself to Muhammad, period. Okay? It's no different than Yeshua made Peter the first pope, period. And he passed the tradition on. Okay? If you don't have those, if you take those things away, you don't have the religion. Okay. Let's go to the next quote.
Hold on, Skip. Isn't the difference with Christianity and Judaism in the sense that they don't debate the meaning? Once they have the doctrine of what the meaning is, that's what the meaning is. They don't debate that. Where Jews debate.
But you're absolutely right. But neither do the rabbis. The rabbis don't continue to debate the meaning of the 10 laws. Okay? And that debate might have gone on for a long time. Like in Christianity, the debate over the Trinity went on for 400 years. But once it was established, that is it. You cannot continue to question it and still be within the, you know, within the confines of doctrinal acceptability, right? Just like I couldn't go to rabbinic Judaism today and say, okay, well, you know, the meaning of Shabbat has nothing to do with what I practice on it because it's only a statement about the creation. Sorry, not acceptable, right? Nobody's debating that anymore. It's now fundamental to Judaism.
Okay. Hey, Skip,
go ahead.
May I ask? Yeah. When that it talks about things being axiomatic, then wouldn't Paul's Damascus Road experience be another example of that? That you can't argue whether or not he had that.
That's right. Yeah. There's no argument that something happened to Paul on the Damascus Road. The only argument is, what does it mean? Who did he see? What did they say? How did he respond? What did that mean? Did he stop being a Jew? Did he become a Christian? As, you know, as Gordon Fee says, well, that was his conversion experience. Is that what really happened there? Nobody argues that it didn't happen, right? By the way, it's interesting that there are plenty of liberal Christian theologians who argue that the resurrection actually didn't happen, right? That it was a mass hallucination. Right? Or that it was a projection of the disciples. Why? Because they don't believe that somebody can come back from the dead. So they actually question the historicity of the text. Right? But no Jew would ever say, well, Moses actually never made it up to the mountain. Right? Sorry. That's not an acceptable beginning to any argument. Okay? Let's look at the next quote. In both Judah and Israel, synchronistic worship, the identification of God of Israel with his and his worship with that of pagan deities, was widespread, even involving some of the kings. And the prophets castigated them for the transgression, as well as for many of the social ills that apparently plagued Israel's society in the period of this divided monarchy. Okay. Now, the reason that I put that quote in there is because Walter Kaufman, you remember? No, Ezekiel Kaufman, in the book that we read by Kaufman called what was the name of the book? Kaufman. We did this study.
The Religion of Israel.
Yeah.
The something of Israel.
The religion of Israel prior to Babylonian captivity.
Yeah. It's on my shelf someplace. Okay. Remember when we did Ezekiel Kaufman's book, and what did he say about this? He said that syncretism wasn't widely spread, that it was pockets, usually involving the royalty, but that in general, the mass of people were untouched by this, just like the mass of people were untouched by the Babylonian captivity, okay? So here we have two scholars whose view is very different about what was actually happening in the general population of Israel, okay? What we have from a biblical perspective are the prophets castigating the people. But as Kaufman points out, that's hyperbole. And deliberately so, because they're trying to motivate change, okay? So, reason I included this little thing is because, you know, this is an example of where you get to go back and start looking at the historical records and decide, oh, which guy is right, Schiffman or Kaufman, right? Okay? Okay, we'll just do a couple more. This is in Genesis. The concept of God as a close family deity worshipped within the familial context is stressed over and over. All of these ideas became major pillars of subsequent Jewish tradition. So we already know that this is the case from our previous studies, right? The book of Genesis, as Nahum Sarna says, is the strangest book in the Bible because all kinds of things happen in Genesis that never happen anyplace else. And in particular, Genesis treats God as what Schiffman calls a close family deity. Genesis does not treat God as the universal sovereign of all creation. Genesis treats God as a particular God of a particular group of people after Abraham, who ultimately become the Jews. But for Genesis, it's really family stuff, right? It's Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph. Maybe it gets extended a little bit, but the relationship to God is real, real tightly knit. And you can see that when Jacob says, when he's traveling back to Laban, he wakes up and he says, oh, I didn't even know God was in this place. In other words, from Jacob's perspective, God is territorial, is geographically confined to the area of the family, right? You see that in Genesis, okay? Why is this important for Schiffman? Because that's the beginning of God choosing one particular people. And from the rabbinic perspective, that gives them the authority to say, don't you realize that God is the God of Israel, not the God of the whole world? You don't get the God of the whole world until you get into Christianity's view of Jesus saving everyone. Okay? In other words, from Schiffman's perspective, the development of the idea of God's relationship to Israel begins in Genesis, and it begins with the family. Okay, so he says, Judaism in ancient times regarded the Torah as having been produced by divine revelation. Every aspect of its text and its diction, therefore, taught some lesson of divine law. Seen in this way and in this spirit, the Torah was able to serve as the basis for the ever-expanding interpretive traditions that constituted the manifold approaches to Judaism. And what he's saying, of course, is the rabbis viewed the Torah given to Moses in two forms as the fundamental construct between God and Israel, and therefore capable of allowing them to continue to embrace it, enlarge it, expand it, and interpret it within the community of the Jews ad infinitum, because it was intended by God for Jews. It wasn't intended for everyone. It was intended for the Jewish population. Okay? Two more, then we're going to stop. Two more quotes. This is the next one. Prophecy has a social dimension. It is not simply a personal religious experience. And of course, this is absolutely fundamental to the way that we read the prophets, because the prophets are not about, I had an experience with God. The prophets are about the social implications of God's revelation to a particular man. The social dimension. And Kaufman, Ezekiel Kaufman, points this out over and over again, right? The prophets come to speak to the social situations of Israel, okay? So in the next one, the discharge of cultic duties was of no significance if, it should be if it, sorry, if it was not accompanied by a life of true moral and ethical principles. And Yeshua says the same thing, but the prophet said this long, long before, right? It doesn't make any difference if you follow all the rules unless you have a transformation of true moral and ethical principles in your life. It's Yeshua's discussion of the outside of the cup and the inside of the cup. Same thing. This idea goes all the way back hundreds of years before Yeshua shows up. Okay? Okay, so I want to do just one more because this is the Genesis account. Under Persian rule, so when does Persia occur? Under Persian rule, right? Under Persian rule, that's the Persian Empire, right? Remember, there's the Assyrians, the Persians, the Babylonians. Ultimately, we're going to end up with Byzantine Empire, then the Romans, the Byzantines, all these different empires that influenced Judaism, okay? Under Persian rule, each subject people was allowed to live by its ancestral laws, which were enforced by the imperial government, okay? Now, this is really important because under Babylon, remember, they carry off all the influencers because they want the culture to adapt to Babylonian ideas. But under Persia, they didn't care. Under Persia, what were they interested in? They were interested in maintaining the calm of the conquered people and paying your taxes. By the way, that's exactly how Rome felt. Okay? So under Persian rule, there wasn't any attempt to change the way the Jewish practices or Jewish worship occurred. They didn't care. As long as you did what the government asked you to do, you could worship any way you wanted. And in fact, violations of the laws of the group to which one belonged constitute an offense against the state precisely because it led to instability. Okay? You can read that exact paragraph and replace Persian rule with Roman law. Right? Because Rome didn't care what your religion was. They wanted stability in the empire and the payment of the tax. And who you worshiped and how you worshiped, they didn't care. It was only after the Jews created instability and refused to pay taxes that the persecutions began. Okay? We have to recognize that Judaism already experienced peaceful occupation because under Persia, they weren't required to become Persians. They could continue to be Jews. They just had to not revolt and pay the bill. Okay? All right, we'll stop there. We went a little bit over the hour, so we'll stop right there.